Before we start this meditation period, I was planning to do something which was to sort of offer some very simple and probably rather brief guidance as the period starts that would lead you into having a taste of a very simple meditation Zen style, which will be rather familiar and not very different from things that you're used to, I imagine. And my thought was that if I do that, those of you who want to follow along and just try it as an experiment can do so. And those of you who would rather do what you would otherwise ordinarily be doing can just tune out my voice and do that. Does anybody sort of not like the sound of that and would rather I just shut up? Because I can keep quiet too, you know. Okay, so in a moment I'll start the period. Oh, well, yeah, I think I'm going to hit it once. You know, we always hit the bell at the start of a period in Zen. So I'll hit it once, and that'll be the start of the period. And then I'll go into this simple instruction on the Zen, what we call Zazen, seated meditation in Zen. And please, just ignore me entirely if you can, and if that's what you'd rather do, you know. Okay. So whether you're sitting on the floor or on a chair, try to have an upright spine. This may mean that it's best to sit at the front of whatever you're sitting on. And if it's a chair, it's good actually to be on the forward edge of the chair with your feet flat on the floor and your legs perpendicular. Either have your eyes closed or slightly open with the gaze lowered. You can rest the hands in the lap, or you can rest them on the knees or the thighs. But try to have an upright spine if possible. You may imagine that there's a thread at the crown of the head gently pulling you up. And notice as it pulls how the back of the head may travel slightly backward, bringing the chin a little bit closer to the spine. It may be that we end up with our chin slightly tucked, rather like we were trying to give ourselves a double chin. Now, as the spine is expanding upward, at the same time the body, the flesh of the body, is relaxing downward toward the floor and the earth. One way to explore the upright posture is to imagine there's a wall right behind us. And the parts of the body that make contact with the wall are the sacrum and the shoulder blades and the back of the head. So just let that be a kind of guide, gently resting against an imaginary wall just behind you. And while we rest there, we start to relax. Let the jaw go. Let the jaw be loose. Let the throat also be loose, and the tongue, not doing anything at all, just resting. Let the shoulders hang, and let the arms hang from the shoulders, and the hands just rest. Let the chest be very, very easy, very loose, very relaxed. Likewise, the diaphragm, middle of the torso, and on down into the belly, and down into the lower abdomen. Warm and loose. And let that warmth and looseness flow down into the hips. Let the hips spread a little. And so on down to the legs, the thighs, the knees, the lower legs, and the feet. Let everything go. As we let our weight go, we become a little more weightless. There's a sense of no need to hold on in the body. No need at all. We're very relaxed, but we're also kind of bright and alert. Upright, but relaxed. We can just spend a moment being aware of sounds. Being aware of sensations, particularly perhaps in the legs and feet and the seat, maybe the hands and arms too. And now let your mind travel down into the pit of the belly and come to rest there, deep in the abdomen. And we start to notice how, with every breath, the abdomen expands as we inhale and contracts with each exhale. It's like a little bellows, steadily pumping away by itself, filling and emptying. And we simply watch that. If you like, you can add a very simple count. 1 on an exhale. 2 on the next exhale. 3 on the next exhale. And so on up to 10. And when we reach 10, we come back to 1. Or you can simply watch. In and out. Belly filling, belly emptying. Sort of like a balloon, inflating, deflating. We don't try to manipulate the breath in any way. We simply watch it. We let it be entirely natural. Whatever it wants to do. Hello, hello. Is this audible? And thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me here, and Anne, of course, and whoever else was involved. Thank you. It's very nice to be in this beautiful place. It's a lovely center you have. Yeah, beautiful statuary as well. And a lovely, I don't know what to call it, garden or yard, yeah. Okay, good. Well, I was asked if I would talk about shunyata and anatta. You know, which are not just hard to translate. Well, I guess anatta is not that hard to translate, but they're basically terms that you may or may not be familiar with, I imagine you probably are, but they reference the unspeakable, what cannot be spoken of. So it's quite a challenge, you know. But I'll do what I can, because they're, in a sense, these terms refer to what the Zen tradition has been devoted to maintaining a kind of access to, or maintaining a process by which a human being can open up to that, which is shunyata and anatta and unspeakable, of, about, unspeakable in every way, you know. Zen isn't really, it's an odd, I mean, the word Zen, by the way, means meditation. It's dhyana, which became channa in China, which then became chan, and became Zen when it moved to Japan. It identifies itself as the meditation school of Buddhism. That's really what Zen Buddhism sort of means. Obviously, you know, there are many other branches and forms of Buddhism in which meditation is important. (clears throat) But Zen has put an emphasis, or less of an emphasis, on other aspects of practice and training, might be true to say. There's a traditional definition of Zen that it has used of itself. It says that it has four marks. It's a transmission outside scripture. Studying scriptures won't convey it. It's a transmission outside scripture, not relying on words and letters. So what is conveyed is not something that can be couched in words or letters. What is discovered is not expressible in words. That's the first two. Then the third one is directly pointing to the human mind. Meaning, in a sense, sort of discovering, really clearly seeing the nature of our own minds. Finding out what are this actual experience of human consciousness actually is. And then the fourth characteristic is becoming Buddha, realizing one is Buddha, which is perhaps a rather provocative or challenging definition or characteristic. Four marks of Zen, these are said to be. So, shunyata and anatta, or poor translations, emptiness, no self. The problem with the word emptiness is it's sort of obviously wrong, because, you know, this quote-unquote emptiness is busy being this stick. It's busy being each one of us here. It's busy being light and nighttime and the whole great earth. So to talk of it as empty is kind of inadequate, you know. To talk of it in any way, I'm afraid, is fundamentally inadequate, actually. But we try anyway. I was in the movies the other day, and, you know, this before the film started, there was this ad, that suddenly just this sort of swirling abstract brown up on the screen. And I go, what's that? And then I realized, oh, of course, it's Coca-Cola, you know. and then no, actually, I was wrong. It's zero. It's Coke Zero, you know. And the tagline was, you don't know zero till you've tried it. Right. So that's a little bit like this shunyata business, you know. You just don't know it till you've tasted it. You know, there's a traditional view that there are kind of three fruits of Zen training. The first is, broadly speaking, what we might call mindfulness, awareness, concentration, presence, centeredness, knowing, you know, being aware that, you know, I'm of what I'm experiencing at any given time, not being lost in thought. Having some, developing some, I don't want to use the word control, but some sort of relationship with the mind and where it likes to go, and being able to having strategies. Of course, you'll know from your own practice that direct sort of approaches to controlling the mind generally don't work terribly well. It's indirect approaches that have a much better chance. We have to be strategic. We don't say, you know, rigidly, stay on the breath, stay on the breath, stay on the breath. It probably won't work. Don't know, no thoughts, no thoughts, you know. If you try to stop having thoughts, you'll generally stir them up even more. But there are ways that we can gradually cultivate an attitude of great patience and great allowing in our practice. And in the space of allowing, our minds will generally settle down. If we're not trying to make them settle down, we're just giving a broad space. You can do what you like, it's okay. You know, and then generally over time, you know, we will get more settled and we will get more focused when we want to be. We will be able to do that. We're gradually developing not only general awareness, but also some peace, a bit more stability, a bit more centeredness, finding that the center is not bland and neutral, it's rather nice. It's rather nice because we're present, so we're able to experience this now. And all of that, I mean, there's much more to it, of course, but all of that is broadly labeled first fruit of Zen practice. Because there's a second one. And the second one is known as Kensho, which means seeing reality. Seeing real nature, or something like that. Seeing the nature. Seeing one's own nature. And this is when we're blessed, graced, with a sudden, totally inexplicable glimpse. And, you know, I could say of shunyata, of anatta. But that doesn't really do it justice. It's a sudden realization. A sudden moment of recognition that this experience we call human life is kind of vastly different from what we've thought it was. It's a moment when, you know, we might afterwards say, sort of, you know, wow, I've had everything wrong. And that is great. It's fantastic. It's sort of, I've been completely wrong, and that's the best possible discovery, you know. You don't know zero till you've tried it, you know. It's actually, there's a cartoon in the New Yorker I once saw that I love. It's a picture. The picture shows God and an archangel kind of bending over the globe, the planet Earth, hanging in space and sort of fizzing and fuming and simmering and obviously quite sickly. Nasty exhaust coming off it and trembling and really unhealthy, you know. And the archangel says to God, "Have you tried turning it off then on again?" And that's kind of what happens in Kensho. It's a sudden, sort of drastic loss of experience. It's suddenly as if all experiencing just vanishes. There's a great early Japanese master, Dogen, and when this happened to him, he said, body and mind fell away. You know, self and world fell away. See, these two terms, anatta and shunyata, in Zen, in the Zen view, you know, real shunyata includes anatta, and real anatta includes shunyata. In other words, if we could make this kind of distinction, we see, in this kind of moment, we see that there is absolutely no difference between me, the seer, and any object that I see. You know, and typically, it may happen in connection with an object, actually. It's quite common for this to be triggered by a random event, you know, that, you know, where suddenly any ordinary phenomenon, you know, and suddenly the separation between the viewer or perceiver and the thing perceived just vanishes. And in that vanishing, the actually the very nature of this world that we look out at and the nature of this self that looks out at it is also done away with. I mean, there's a famous story of a master called Kyogen, who was a very promising, actually a very gifted scholar. This is the kind of story Zen loves. And he went to study with a great master, Isan, and he brought all his scrolls, and, you know, he presented himself as a really learned young chap. And Isan asked him a question. He said, well, what is your face from before the time your parents were born? You know, a real sort of Zen, nasty little Zen thing. You know, how are you supposed to get your head around that? So Kyogen went off to all his scrolls and commentaries, his sutras and sastras, and searched through them all night long, trying to find the right answer that he could then bring to the master in the morning. He couldn't find anything. And he came to him crestfallen and said, I'm sorry, I failed. I can't find the answer. Please tell me the answer. And Isan said, I could tell you, but you wouldn't thank me later. And Kyogen then left the monastery and lived as an itinerant laborer, feeling that he didn't have what it took to be a monk. And somehow, in the process of Zen training, very often actually, there is a sort of, we need to get humbled, you know, and we will. We will, because meditation is, as you know, it's not that easy to make it do what you want it to do, you know. And that's good. We'll get deeply humbled by it. To the point where Kyogen one day was taking care of a little shrine in a rustic part of China, far from anywhere. And he was sweeping the yard. This is years later. And he happened to flick a little piece of broken tile with his broom. And it flew and puck, hit against a bamboo growing nearby. And when he heard that sound, that little tuck, you know, he had a great experience. He had a great awakening. He and the sound became one. And in that oneness, everything vanished. And he was shaken to his core. You know, he was trembling and sweating. And actually, he went and, the story is that he went and bathed, changed his robes, lit incense and bowed in the direction of Isan's temple, because he now knew the answer. What was his original face before his parents were even born? Let alone he himself, before even his parents were born. What was his original face? And he found it. And sure enough, he actually went back to Isan and presented his understanding of that question. And he said, you're so right. Because you didn't tell me, now I've found it. You know, and if he hadn't been given that imponderable question, and if it hadn't led him to go through the process he's just been through, the despondency, you know, the sense of failure, and presumably gradually coming to be okay with that, you know, he wouldn't have had this greatest of all experiences, which is waking up to who we really are. Letting go of who we think we are. So that's the second fruit of Zen. And then the third fruit of Zen is, it's living that. It's living that discovery in daily life, which is, of course, an endless training. And how wonderful that it is that we always are students. You know, we're students of the great way. We'll never really know what all this is, you know. All we can do is try to do better, you know, be more helpful, be less harmful. So that's a little map of Zen, but to come back to shunyata and anatta, just on a sort of conceptual level, I mean, Zen talks about, in Japanese, hoku and ninku. This little word ku, K-U, literally means empty sky. And ho means the 10,000 things, all forms, all phenomena. Everything from, you know, this cup of water to the great earth itself, to a river, to a thought, to feeling hungry. You know, all phenomena are made of empty sky. All phenomena are ku. At the same time, there's ninku, and nin means the self, the perceiver, the experiencer, is also made of empty sky. Self is sky. So if we just apply that to Kyogen's story, I mean, at the moment that the pebble hits the bamboo, you know, the sky that is that phenomenon, sound, and the sky that is who Kyogen has thought he is, they meet. It's one sky. And it's, and you know, when this happens to us, it's a very, I mean, it can be a real sort of turning point in a life. You know, if we're ripe and our practice is mature and ready, sort of thing. You know, it's a bolt of lightning that falls, and it really can sweep away so much of how we've lived, and how we've understood things. So it's a great, it's a fulcrum, really, of a human life, I think, to, if we have a sort of a thorough, deep experience like this. At least that's the Zen view. We don't really, I mean, of course, you know, you'll understand that, you know, it's just the knock of a pebble on a bamboo, or a piece of tile on bamboo. It's a flash, it's an instant. So the majority, of course, of a life of practice and training in Zen, you know, is not that. The majority of it is this ongoing letting go, letting go, letting go, allowing, 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 being, just being and allowing. And we're certainly not sort of practicing in an expectation or hope that this kind of thunderbolt will fall from the heavens, you know. But it does actually. It does, but it doesn't if we're trying, if we're wanting it, you know. It comes when least expected, sort of thing. But it's regarded as crucial in Zen, because without that sort of a revelatory, transformative moment, none of these guys and women who became Zen teachers in the great history of Zen could have done it without that, because that was what revealed to them what Zen was really, quote-unquote, about, what this practice is really about. And I just want to quote a little bit, actually, from a master who lived in the late 7th, early 8th centuries, from 677 to 744, called Nangaku Edjo. And he was studying with another master called Wei Neng, a famous figure in Zen, who, I'll just get you his dates. I can't quite remember them off the top of my head. He lived from 638 to 713. Anyway, so he's a Chinese, remark of two Chinese guys, you know. And Nangaku comes to Wei Neng, and Wei Neng, who's the master in this dialogue, says, "Where do you come from?" Nangaku says, "From Mount Sung." Wei Neng says, "What is it that thus comes? What is it that has thus come?" And Nangaku couldn't answer. After 8 years of studying that question, Nangaku suddenly had a great realization. And he told Wei Neng, saying, "I have an understanding." And Wei Neng said, "What is it?" And Nangaku said, "To say it's a thing misses the mark. It's wrong to say it's a thing." And Wei Neng said, "Then can it be made evident or not? Can it in any way be shown? Can it be made plain?" And Nangaku said, "I don't say that it can't be made evident, But it can't be defiled. And Wei Neng said, just this that is undefiled is precisely what is upheld and sustained by all Buddhas. You are thus, I am also thus. Now, I don't know whether that was clear, but this, I'll just go over that that little bit, really, that he says, so I've got an understanding. And Wei Neng says, well, what is it? And Nangaku says, to say it's something is wrong. I can't say it's something. You know, he's had this, you know, great awakening. He said, you know, it's not something. And then Wei Neng says, well, is it evident? Is it manifest or not? You know, is it showing anywhere? Well, of course, actually, of course it is. It's showing everywhere, all the time. And then Nangaku's answer is, I don't say that it can't be manifest, just that it can't be defiled. Nothing can touch it, and yet we're touching it all the time, you might say.
I'm sorry, are you saying defiled or defined?
Undefiled. Defiled. Defiled, like spoiled. That's right, yeah, thanks for checking. Yeah, like spoiled in any way. Contaminated in any way. Because there's nothing there to contaminate. It's completely free. Completely boundless. But it's not something. See, this is where we get into trouble if we use a word like shunyata. You know, it's not a thing. But it's also not nothing. And in fact, the whole principle of Zen teaching is teaching through things, actually. You know, we have a strange methodology of which you've now had a taste, really, of two examples. It's known as the koan in Zen. Infamous, infuriating, nasty little buggers, you know. Koans, you know, where the famous koan is, what is this? You know the sound of two hands clapping. But what is the sound of one hand? Or another famous one with Joshu is, does a dog have Buddha nature? Joshu answered, M-U, which means literally not. And we meditate with this little syllable, moo, moo, exhaling moo, till the cows come home. Moo, 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 you know. And it makes no sense. We don't know what on earth we're doing, you know. But actually, there's a long heritage of people who've sat with this inscrutable little syllable, moo, and had a great realization about what a human being really is, what consciousness is, what experience is, what this whole world is, you know. So Zen teaches with objects. There's a story I love about one of the desert fathers in Egypt in the 2nd century CE, you know, these desert fathers lived in little caves and hermitages in, I think there was actually a particular valley where they sort of, I mean, they were hermits, so it would be wrong to say they congregated, but they were scattered through this valley. And usually they would have scripture with them, you know, some books of the Bible, and they'd meditate on them and pray for them or whatever, do what they did. But there was one father, I forgot his name, who didn't have any scripture, and he was renowned for that. And visitors came and asked him, you know, why don't you have any scripture? He said, what need do I have of scripture? Wherever I look, it's the book of creation. You know, this is the Dharma right in front of us all the time. This is the Zen view, that it's things, it's dogs. It's stubborn little syllables like, you know, it's pebbles and it's bamboo and it's brooms and it's, I mean, the koan, so-called, are full of things, bridges and bamboo and trees and dogs and cats and all the rest of it, and robes and bells and radishes. Great Master Joshu was once asked, the question he was asked is a little inscrutable to a non-Zen audience. But it boils down to, what is Zen? Master, what is Zen? And Joshi said, the province of Qin produces giant radishes. Another master, Seigen, was asked, what is the real core of Buddhism? What is the real essence of Buddhism? Please, master, help me. This practice is supposed to help alleviate my suffering. This Buddhism will help me, I know it. What is the essence of Buddhism? Help me. Master Seigen answers, what is the price of rice in Roryo? Roryo apparently produced some fancy rice. What is the price of rice these days in Roryo? Now, it may seem that these guys are just being facetious, or just ludicrous, or just plain stubbornly inscrutable. But from their point of view, they're not. They're directly answering the question that's been asked in the most immediate way they can. Another time Joshua was asked, what is Zen? The oak tree in the garden. You really want to know who you are? The oak tree in the garden. Something like that. So I don't know whether I've really managed to address shunyata and anatta, emptiness and no self. I don't really know, but I can say I think with assurance that these two terms are referencing the sort of core. A reality. And what Zen has been devoted for, we would say, 2,500 years, probably much longer, to trying to convey. As one master, who was it? Bansho. He said, when the four mountains are closing in on you, how will you escape? Four mountains being birth, old age, sickness, and death. When they're closing in on you, how will you escape? This is Zen's way of helping us. Do precisely that. Waking up from the dream or nightmare. And then being able to help to make it a better dream. Okay, so I'm going to stop right there, and I don't know that I'll be able to do it, but I can try to answer any questions if anybody has any. Well, actually, this question, what is your face before your parents were born, it was first posed by this other guy I mentioned, Wei Neng, who was the one who asked Nangaku, where have you come from? And who then said to him, what is it that thus comes? This question, what is your face before your parents were born, was put by him to a monk who, it's a bit of an involved story, let me see if I can really abbreviate it. No, I don't think I can, so I won't go that way. Okay. You wanted to know, what is this question about the face before your parents were born have to do with the pebble, the sound of the pebble. Is that right?
Yes.
To put it there. Okay, well, basically, we are meeting this original face all the time. Right now, you know, you and I, we're staring at the original face from before our parents were born. Now, one way we could explain this, there's a great master in our lineage called Yamada Cohen. He used to explain by means of a fraction. He said that the top half of the fraction is all phenomena, n in mathematical terms, you know, n like numerator. The numerator of the fraction, right, is all phenomena, whether it's stick or question or pen or car or thunderstorm, whatever. The underneath the denominator, the bottom half of the fraction, is empty and is infinite and is one and is boundless. Now, all phenomena that arise are this fraction, but we tend only to see the top half of it, the numerator. So this moment, this second fruit of Zen, this kensho, is a moment when suddenly we discover the bottom half of the fraction, the denominator, that has always been here, and it's infinite, and it's empty, and it's unbelievably creative and powerful, all-powerful, you know, and marvelous, and kind of horrifying, because it's so radically different from what we've experienced. We come to terms with it over time through the training, but it's a shock. And, you know, the Zen view is that if there isn't a quality of shock, it's not quite enough. This awakening experience must be a surprise, because it so inverts the way we've understood things. Yeah, there is. But it's not the kind of content that we can arrive at conceptually. They're actually trying to convey something that cannot be got through thought. When Sagan says, "What is the price of rice?" he's actually showing, I mean, from his point of view, he's showing the whole universe. If we get underneath the ostensible meaning, to experience them just as a fact, just as a phenomenon, what is the price of rice? I mean, if our minds are going slow enough, like, you know, the bicycle wheel that's slowing right down until it's stopped, an inverted bike, you know, as kids we used to love whirring the wheel round, pedals and the wheel goes, you know, and then it slows down and it eventually stops. And if our minds have come to rest, then maybe we can just taste a little hem of Sagan's robe. He says, "What is the price of rice?" That he's actually giving something enormous just by saying that. Now, if we're looking for a rational, conceptual understanding, it won't work. This is not on that level. This is about, actually, it's about the real nature of experience and of consciousness. He's talking directly from what he's discovered about the actual living reality of being human. His mind is not really involved, you know. I mean, he's still, I'm sure, a sharp guy, you know, able to be incisive and stuff. But he's sharing something huge and marvelous and empty all at once. Because basically, I mean, what this is really all about, this strange Zen way, is it's really about love. It's about love as the underlying principle of everything. I feel, you know, that when we discover so sort of fundamentally that, you know, we are okay, you know, that we are beloved, you know, we are a gift that's been freely given, and so is everybody, and so is everything. It's actually hard to put into words the sense of communion, the sense of participation. The sense is more than participation. The sense of, actually, there's a koan that speaks of the, you know, a clearly enlightened person never stops crying. You know, they're just. This same guy I mentioned, Yamada Cohen Roshi, you know, he felt that, you know, this strange Mahayana paradox that is expressed in a number of Mahayana sutras, that, you know, if you think there are beings to save, you can't save beings. If you know there are no beings to save, you can save beings. You know, I mean, maybe that sounds a little theoretical and intellectual. I don't know. I think when we experience that for ourselves, it's very powerful, transformative, because when there, you know, really, certainly, I speaking a little personally, you know, to have lived so dominated and dictated by my own sense of self, and to, through the patient sort of guidance of my teachers, to somehow be much more free of that, you know, and to have much less of an agenda, basically. Really, not to have much of an agenda, you know. And what then is left? I mean, it's a different world. It's a different world, and it's full of love given and received constantly. I don't know. I'm not sure I've done a very good answer, actually. I mean, I'm okay. Well, that's probably enough, right? Yeah. Too much, maybe. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.